Welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know in the world of innovation, business, design, tech, and culture. I'm Fazlin Esau, all the way from Cape Town, South Africa. Today, we're welcoming two brand new label mates from all over the world to our growing list of experts. We're also joined by Label Sessions founder, Nick Sherrard. Nick, what are we diving into this week?
So this week, we want to talk about, I guess, a big topic, but it's how can we build products and brands that bring a bit more joy to the world? Because it certainly seems that there's a bit of a conversation going on just now around digital products and whether they can be more positive and even more playful. Next, we then want to go on to talk around how we should think about new tech that can change the world, but can also harm it in some ways. And in particular, talking around some of the implications of AI. And then finally, we want to talk around one of the most kind of iconic ethical brands that's around, but has maybe faced some challenges recently, and ask, what is the future of Patagonia?
Lee, we're also welcoming Josh Nixon, our content producer here. Josh, what can we expect content-wise from Label Sessions this week?
Yeah, so we're continuing our push with low mix accelerators. So we've got our few accelerators coming out, where they're out right now, with Sonic Brandon with Vince Corner. We have cybersecurity, cyber innovation with Jez Coldstone. And then we also have, forgive me, we also have Ravi Bala's consumer duty accelerator. Sorry, there's so many accelerators floating around that it's boggling my mind right now. We have a couple more coming out very soon. One focused on fusion innovations, which is coming in the pipeline, as well as plenty more. There's one to do with procurement also, which is another little fun fact. So plenty.
That and procurement, a huge thing currently, obviously, all over. So let's dive right in. First, a big welcome to Nicholas Babin. Nicholas is a global AI pioneer, digital transformation leader, and an innovation strategist with nearly four decades of experience in technology, business, and culture. As one of the very few who can say he launched AI before it became a buzzword. Nicholas, what are the hard questions leaders need to be asking themselves right now when it comes to AI?
It's how should I implement it? It's not a question of should I implement it? It's really how. And really working with the teams available within, obviously, the companies in order to put a plan in place that's going to start small and then step by step allow a full deployment of AI tools. So AI can be used everywhere in any company, in any industry. That's, I think now everybody has agreed to that and can see the benefits of AI. Obviously, the last 2 years, we've seen a huge rise in AI use because of the LLMs types of products that we've all seen with OpenAI and Google and Microsoft and many others that have launched great products, but frankly, that touch no more than 1% of what AI can really do. Because, you know, as you said, and as I've said as well, I've been with AI for 29 years now, and really at the beginning, AI has always been built for augmented humans, and this is really. I remember the first meeting I had about AI, never heard the term before, in 1996 with Sony, when our founder, Dr. Doi, the founder of AIBO, the robot, started to say, you know, I don't want people to be scared. I want AI to be a tool that will augment humans. And that's exactly what we did. And we never had anything else in mind. And obviously, you don't know what you don't know. And so when you launch a new product, you know, you have that vision. And it was really important. So what I see today, you know, with all the ethical issues, and I know we'll talk about that in the next paragraph, if I can say, you know, it's really hard for me because AI has always been built as a tool with human as a center of that. And so, you know, how can CEOs, any CXOs, companies need to approach AI is by saying, okay, it's going to help my teams to be more productive. It's going to help my teams to avoid doing the mundane stuff that they don't want to do, mundane tasks that they don't want to do. And I'm talking about tasks that could be physical, and then you can use robots, but also tasks that, you know, people don't want to do, enter an Excel spreadsheet, even to some extent do some coding. And, you know, if you're in healthcare, helping imagery, so like radiologists to understand better about the tumor, oncologists to understand better how cancer can spread or not, you know, all these type of things, because AI is not just about LLMs. AI is about many different type of models. And in each activity, each industry can use a different type of model. Obviously, LLMs can be used across the board because it's about mainly content creation, whether it's image, videos, or at least text. But the other type of AIs, which are about predicting, recognizing a picture, helping imagery, all these things are also extremely important. So what I want to say in just a sentence is use AI, obviously, and ensure that you do it in a smart way that everybody buys into it, because it's a change management project, not a digital management project. Digital comes last.
Also, a big welcome to Selina Agaton. Selina helps organizations and governments unlock the potential of open data, tourism, creative industries, and agriculture. Her work spans conflict zones, corporate boardrooms, and cultural hubs, consistently bringing together diverse players from military institutions to grassroots organizations to solve complex global issues. Selina, what are some of the things that are exciting you right now when it comes to climate and sustainability?
Yeah, I mean, we have to look at the actual impact of the act of climate research in itself, because it carries such a high environmental footprint. So I'm happy to say that with my local data economy model, we can do a fully local climate and disaster risk modeling program, where it's usually hundreds and thousands of dollars to produce that level of data. And we're able to hire local people to do that using their smartphones and drones. So that means that all those budgets can be converted into wages, and anyone can be taught to learn these methodologies. So mostly non-technical people are doing this work, which is really what I'm most excited about, is bringing access to technology as well as impact at a rate that never has been possible before.
Incredible. That's amazing. Awesome. So we'll jump straight into some of the topics that have been permeating the worlds of business, tech, innovation, and design this week. To kick it off, the internet used to be fun. And it's been starting to feel a lot less fun of late. But a new wave of brands and platforms are trying to maybe bring back a bit of that fun. So Digg is making a comeback with an emphasis on creating good vibes. AI aliens are becoming virtual best friends. And there are also AI apps like Pi, which are aiming to help people make new real friends. And even Crocs is letting people design their own little charm thingies. I don't know what they're called.
It's a technical term, the charm thingies.
Are we seeing the start of a new internet era that's more based on creativity, joy, human connection, instead of doom scrolling and division? Why do we think people are craving a more playful and positive internet right now? Nicholas.
Great. Thank you. Very, very important question as well. I will be a little bit more balanced than you on this one. I know you were trying to open up the floor here. On one end, you know, we're seeing rise in fake news, deep fakes, and worrying news about the geopolitical situation in the world. And so I think people are tired. I'm speaking about myself here. I'm sick and tired of waking up in the morning and turning on my phone. It gives me, you know, this knot in my stomach, basically, just thinking, what's next, you know? And then you hear Zuckerberg saying, well, sorry, we're not going to do fact checks anymore. You see what's going on X, less and less people do, but I still manage to do from time to time. And so it's worrying. So I think human brain is just trying to escape from this and trying to go into a happier, greener place. That's how I would interpret it. I'm really glad to see it happening because I think we need it. And I think society as a whole needs it. Every single country in the world needs it. However, I don't think we're there yet. And when you talk about making real friends online, when you talk about, you know, those new apps, some of them are, you know, absolutely no problem whatsoever. But some of them can bring some very important ethical issues that will need to be looked at. So obviously in Europe, and one thing that I have not mentioned, but I think you have in your introduction, is I'm a digital EU ambassador working for the European Commission. And one thing that we did last August is we launched the AI Act, which is, amongst many others, because a year ago we launched the Digital Services Act, a little bit before we launched the Digital Markets Act, which are really legislations. And I know this is really something that people tell me all the time, is like, yeah, in Europe you know how to legislate and you forget about the innovation. Well, I will take that as another question probably, because we do a lot for innovation as well. But AI Act was really to ensure that at least we install transparency and trust in everything around AI, because people are worried, and rightfully so. You know, technology has evolved so much. Again, 29 years ago when we launched AIBO, the AI code was done on the first one was a 4 megabyte memory stick. We didn't have internet in 1996, right? So we had to think about all the potential AI element with very limited technology paradigm, basically. So at this time, we were not worried about, you know, ethical issues, because there was not much you could do on a 4 megabyte memory stick then. So today, it's definitely an issue that's really important to tackle. I'm glad to see that some apps are really trying their best to make it a little bit more fun and a little bit lighter than what we see on a day-to-day basis. But I think, you know, there's a lot of work to do in order to make everybody comfortable, in the sense that, you know, fact-checking is definitely something that we need, because if you base your judgment on something that's false and a lie, then obviously what your judgment is going to be, you know, wrong. I'm very balanced. I'm inclining more towards the fact that we're not there yet, but hoping that society as a whole is going to make a big transformation in the trends that we see today.
Yeah, well, I'm taking this down the route of, you know, where my communities live right now, and there's definitely a greater need for trust, for accountability, and better governance. And the realities are not as positive, and we absolutely need those, you know, the good news stories. But once you're stuck in that algorithm, one wrong click and you're down a wormhole of doom. In terms of what's happening right now in the digital spaces that I work with, especially with AI involved in, you know, every aspect of every industry that I'm working in right now, at least now there's finally the trend on localization, because the reality is that all the global funding from the OECD, you know, it was a very recent study conducted globally that showed that less than 10% of economic and humanitarian funding actually reaches local community organizations. And it's even worse off for women's organizations, where, you know, gender rights funding is reaching less than 1% of local women's organizations. And donors, you know, funders aren't doing enough due diligence in understanding who they fund, and largely because the decision makers aren't from those communities. And that's why I've been so passionate about the geospatial element, because then we know who's collecting the data. Are they from the community? We can 100% validate and verify if data was collected accurately, if it was processed accurately and analyzed accurately, because a lot of effort, especially in you know, women and BIPOC communities globally, their efforts are often appropriated for fundraising efforts for Western organizations. So while, you know, we need to go beyond, these beautiful websites and actually have people on the ground verifying whether people are good to work with, no matter what sector they're in. And we can do better in the monitoring and accountability aspect of it, which is, you know, where there's huge potential in AI. There always has been the validation potential with geospatial data, because you can physically see if there's movement, if things were built, you know, what the disaster risk is. And yet a lot of that was hidden. It's harking back to, you know, 15 years ago when open data was launched. It's still a largely unknown concept. Open source technology is still largely unknown, and much of the leadership I deal with across the sectors, and a lot of the Western donors as well. So it's going back to those roots, you know, where all the positive days of the internet were, but to ensure that there are these safe spaces for communities to thrive and better accuracy on what is actually being funded and what kind of actions, you know, are being maintained where the money is supporting.
It's really interesting that I hadn't thought about that connection point, because that idea of almost a return to the roots of open source, and there's almost like a chapter that happens in our kind of digital history that we're kind of unwinding, because essentially across everything there was a certain internet that was formed that was basically, in a sort of social sense, was pretty much the social media platforms that then became the social media algorithms that became like the pretty much the binding force of the internet that everybody was on in every part of the world. They were all kind of affected through the same thing. Or using the same platforms. And that's breaking down now quite rapidly, which then means you get things like digs breaking up, or this kind of moment in digital product design where people are saying, hey, well, we can build weird things again. You know, the way the internet used to be quite weird and playful for a while, that's coming back in that sense. But on the flip side, also in terms of the more important part of digital and the internet, there's almost like a rethinking going on, to your point, Selena, which is like there's lots of things that have become very established in terms of how you validate people, what a supply chain looks like. You know, I think Josh mentioned before, there's a lot of innovation leaders we work with now who are saying, actually, I want to look at how procurement works, how my supply chain gets built, as much as I want to do the kind of classic ESG thing. This is a kind of really interesting moment of almost going back to first principles and thinking, what are we doing online? Is it achieving what we want it to? And are we doing it deliberately? Whereas 5 years ago, it was all just automatic. If you want to build a brand, you kind of build it on a social media platform. If you want to build a new operation, you kind of validate it through these very established routes. It's kind of an interesting moment.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, and I'm always harping on the mapping side, because the process of mapping is discovery. And so where we find, you know, hidden histories, we find amazing tourism sites, amazing new businesses, and also where those challenges lie, where, you know, we make the invisible visible through the maps. And that way investors, you know, public programs can fast track help into those communities. And so that part of the transparency is really key. But we're also at that point in history with all the massive cuts that are happening, and some of them are well justified, because the cost is largely going towards multilateral organizations versus the intended communities. This is a time for, you know, open source, for open data, and the whole open community that has largely been pushed to the corners by the tech bros for the most part, and redefine that innovation is meant to serve people. And that's looking at the community benefit ratio of how much is this project really intending to support the community, or are we supporting contractors? And in the terms of the greatest barriers to human progress, and a lot of that is infrastructure, where so many communities are missing essential infrastructure and essential business infrastructure. And that's a global issue. It's an urban and rural issue. And being able to provide better governance for this. It's better taxpayer dollars, but it's also helping support communities with exactly what they need by identifying first, you know, what's missing and then what's there, and then blending the two together to create more effective programming.
That's interesting to say. So you're quite hopeful in a way around what actually the tech as such can provide once the tech pros are gone, almost. You sound quite like genuinely hopeful around digital still.
I mean, I do use AI as well in rare circumstances, because then I look at the cost. All our tools are free and open source. And so if I can pay, 200 staff 2 to 5 times higher wages and largely remotely, all this innovation was driven during the pandemic. And it's 100% verifiable with, 95% accuracy, then I'm going to choose that versus hiring an external group to build very extensive AI. And AI has had negative impacts, especially in the conservation space and in the infrastructure mapping space, because of the model that's been developed with a lot of folks that aren't familiar with conservation models or local conservation models, being able to differentiate species, for example, because a lot of the tech bros are Western. And so these models aren't built with the localization that's needed, that representative data that's needed to really, provide accuracy and accountability.
I will say I'm hopeful if the tech bros go away that things will be a lot better. Nick, I'll go on the record definitely with that one. We're now Microsoft's CSO, Chief Sustainability Officer, has just admitted that AI is delaying their climate goals. It's throwing a curveball into the idea that tech always drives progress. So what is the move? Do we double down on AI's potential or really start questioning whether some things need to be slowed down? Do we pause and reassess, or do we just jump in? Salida, you have this look on your face like you want to jump. You want to jump right in.
Well, I'm always representing, the cheap labor that fuels AI. It's always this side of the world, Africa and Asia. And that's what's driving a lot of the economic boom right now in this side is all the data centers and all, the water scarcity issue, all the energy use, et cetera. And I fully, I've been part of the innovation community for more than 25 years now. And it's finding that balance and again, looking at the, what the benefit is, not tech for just the sake of tech, even though it's very hard pressed because it's too exciting and too alluring for a lot of donors, right now aren't even asking what you need. It's like, what can you build with AI? So that becomes the first step of it. So, absolutely the potential is there for a number of, across, all the industries, but it's also looking at the harm it's bringing into communities. And that's often the hidden price of innovation.
I couldn't agree more. Could not agree more. I mean, again, when the word artificial intelligence was created, it was 1956 in Dartmouth, University of Dartmouth in the US. And at the time it was basically only used for analytics. Right. It was in British English, it would have been called cleverness if it had been like, for example, this is one of the issue that I find in German or in French is that people are always challenging me saying, well, where's the intelligence in there? It's true. So in terms of the tech, I could not agree more. We need to be very balanced and maybe we need to think about still using AI, but in a different way that's going to be more protective to the planet. One example I want to give is what I see, the work is being done right now for the 6G launch, right? I launched 4G with Sony at the time. We had the Sony Ericsson. You probably remember that. And 4G was the world's worst disaster in terms of ecology. I mean, for the planet, it was terrible. We had those huge data centers that had huge, energy savvy type of servers, and also trying to cool down because they needed to work in a very cold environment and all this. 5G was a little bit better because in terms of the captors and everything, it was a bit better. It was not good, but it was better than 4G. And we started to use cooling liquids, which were less energivore. At least less energy savvy type of technology. And 6G is really going to be better. Not again good, but at least, the problem we face today is we're on a journey, a never-ending journey. Can you tell people, stop using your computers, stop using the internet, stop using your cell phone? It's impossible. We have to be pragmatic about these things. So what I found ourselves is if think about it. If your grandparents or great-grandparents had said no to electricity or the telephone when they were at the time faced with these new technologies, we would be in a very different place today. But they said yes. And, you know, because of that, or thanks to that, we're in a space where it's hard to go back. It's impossible to go back. So my point here is, like, let's try to find a place where we can be more balanced. And that's exactly what Selena was saying, is like, you know, we need to be more balanced. We need to find a way that technology is going to evolve, that I totally agree. We need to find a way also that gaps between Asia, Africa, and the rest of the world is also narrowing, because it's not fair that what we're seeing. But also, we have a fantastic, powerful tool at our disposal. And what I've seen, for example, in Singapore, and what the benefits they've tried to do with the Smart City Initiative and using AI for better grid usage, that's also fantastic, for better management of traffic. I mean, I stayed almost a month in Singapore and there was no traffic and I couldn't believe it. All the lights were very well, very well managed and very well organized and everything. So what I'm saying here is that the pollution that comes from traffic, the stress that comes from traffic, all the bad elements around traffic basically was didn't exist. So we could definitely find a way of using AI in a different setup. It's the same with emails. It's the same with internet. You know, when we first launched internet, when we first launched emails, we never thought about saving the planet. You know, sending an email today is actually costing a lot of energy. And it's the same with AI. So my take into all this is, let's try to be a little bit more balanced and use AI for the benefits of humans and the planet. We need to have the planet in mind 24/7. That's how I see it.
Yeah. I think there's a related thing there as well, because I know most people listening to this will be a leader in an organization of some kind. And I think there's a really interesting moment or like process to think through, because I think what's happened is we probably have a bias, I guess, label sessions, clients, whatever. They're leading innovation, but they've got an interest in sustainability and these kind of areas. And whereas a few years ago, I think those people would have had the kind of slightly digital utopian thing of like, we can reinvent everything, let's just go ahead. Now, sometimes it's almost a bit of a cultural moment, I think, of almost going overcorrecting. So it feels like everything we do is hyper dangerous. So, you know, that actually like human creativity is somewhere to be feared. I think it's a really interesting thing if you're a leader of an organization right now, is that of course you have to get your head around what this new technology means and what the possibilities might be. And some of those might be positive. But the big lever to pull, I think, if you're leading an organization that isn't Microsoft or Google or one of the big tech players, is to actually make really clear to those organizations which you are buyers of, that actually the supply chain they build is going to be really important. And actually, that's partly from a climate change perspective. It's also from a resilience perspective, because actually, if you're building this off infrastructure as it's currently envisaged, at least, because some of the subtext to that statement from the Microsoft CSO was kind of, hey, you know, we're not going to hit our targets, but you've kind of told us we have to do AI, so like it's going to be okay. And I think part of the message, it's not going to be. Yeah, no, it's not going to be, from the companies they work with or from a resilience perspective. I think that's the thing.
Yeah, but it sounds to me like it's an excuse. You know, it's an easy excuse, and the target is AI because, oh yeah, everybody wants AI. Yeah, okay, very trendy. But hang on, you Microsoft, one of the biggest company in the world, I'm sure you can find a better way to use AI and of how to use AI, you know? But is Microsoft going to stop on AI? Yeah, I'm ready to put a tenner on this one.
No, but it's interesting how. It's also that point to what Selena was talking about before as well, because I think also the debate in Europe and America now on AI has become very much around sustainability in a kind of quite abstract sense. Actually, so especially the bigger companies are in a place where they can start to talk around, well, where are the data centers? What's actually happening in those data centers? What's happening in the communities around that? That's a really interesting space, I think, if you're, especially for ESG leaders and those companies, right. But for any leader of that company to start to say, well, that's actually, as part of our AI strategy, let's work out where we're sourcing this technology from, as we would do anything else. And let's look at whether we think what they're doing is going to cause us a problem in 5 years, 10 or 10 years time, either from a climate change perspective or from a pure resilience perspective.
Yeah. But the challenge is, you have the technology. This is how it works today. Let's make it work to save the planet as well. That's basically what I would expect from Microsoft.
It's going back to, you know, the frugal science that, you know, again, was at its peak 15 years ago. And then so many people now that I speak to haven't heard of Raspberry Pi. And there's so many amazing tools and citizen science. Like, remember citizen science? It's, you know, it's re-explaining it to folks these days, but there's so much amazing and low-cost technology available at our fingertips to add a lot of the validation to, you know, to pollution, to traffic, to all kinds of things that can be done at very low cost. So it's not like before where PUC was very complicated and very expensive. That way, at least your, you know, your data inputs going into building these models come at a much lower rate and again, employing local people.
Exactly.
Actually, is the ethical consumption under capitalism, right? That's the, the big question.
That's exactly it.
What is the future for Patagonia? So Patagonia has always been a brand that has meant something. It's a favorite brand here in the Label Sessions team. But does meaning something and having value guarantee survival? Because while they're doubling down on their values, they're also struggling commercially. So can a brand built on purpose stay relevant in a world where so much has shifted?
Well, I'm sorry if I can jump in on this one. The experience I have, I think, can speak of itself. I'm talking about Sony here. It started in 1946, just after the war, by two Japanese, brilliant Japanese guys, with only a vision to have better sound. Sony comes from sonus in Latin, which meant the sound. And you look at the company, still alive, but struggling like Patagonia is. I don't know. Frankly, I've not looked at Patagonia's numbers in a while, so I have no idea in terms of where they stand. But at least the impression you get from outside is that the two companies are struggling. And why is that? It's because, you know, it's like the Nokias of this world and everything. It's because they haven't transformed themselves quick enough in terms of, you know, riding the trend waves that they should have. For example, at Sony, and I was part of that the team then, they invented, over 15 years, it's still hard to say, they invented Walkman, right? So iPod should have actually been a Sony product. Well, the problem was that Sony had a branch called Sony Music, and they were trying to protect that brand and also that business of the brand. And so they could not afford to do a piece of music at 99 cents the way Apple was doing it. So Sony tried to do the right things at the time, which was, well, we're going to have better quality sound, which was part of the vision. Definitely, but people were not prepared to pay $2 or $1.50 when they could have it for 99 cents on Apple. So that started to get the business. And then they missed the TV turn, which was, you know, going LCD or LED at the time. And so they stayed with the old technology of the cathodic tubes, which definitely was not the right way forward. Obviously, you had a very heavy TV on one hand, still good quality and good quality sound, but on the other hand, you had a very sexy TV with that was very, very, very small. So we've seen it so many times. I mean, I mentioned Nokia. Nokia has exactly been the same thing. Nokia started with very different businesses, and now is in a total different business. When, you know, when I was a teenager, Nokia was great. Well, not teenager. Sorry, I was already an adult. But they were the first cell phones. You remember that we all had that Nokia phone. It was a fantastic phone. We all liked it. Now Nokia doesn't make phones anymore. So, you know, these companies need to adapt or die. And that's basically what it comes through. They could have the best vision in the world. They could have the best people in the world if they don't adapt to what's important. So obviously for Patagonia, what's important is about sustainability, it's about saving the planet. And that's why they have the right vision. But I'm not sure they have the right strategy. And again, from outside, I have absolutely no information, so I don't know. But what I see from outside is I believe that they should really rethink their transformation in order to continue be a very valuable brand?
Yeah, well, I'm a Patagonia fan as well, but it's the same with a company that produces quality products, that they last so long, so you're not having to buy them as much. And the market has changed with from specialty to more casual folks from the pandemic. So how do you shift with that model? Everybody is going to be struggling these days. Do they go, they have their resale model. Is it going to, would a blended kind of rent the runway model work? I mean, even Rent the Runway is struggling. So, I mean, it's going to be a hard fix with, especially with the lack of, more disposable income and the way the economy is going. So it's going to have to be a rethink. And I don't know, they were at scale, so what that means in the future.
There is also a pattern with Patagonia as well. Like everywhere we look at sustainable brands, there is a real problem right now where you try and make the brand the hero. Like I think the thing that's really working with sustainable brands is now is when you make the consumer the hero. So the fact you bought this thing makes you a good person. You're going to go and make a change happen in where you are and all this kind of stuff. Patagonia, it's a bit like even Ben and Jerry's we talked about a couple of weeks ago, another classic kind of purpose-driven brand. But they're kind of in this place where it's kind of like their founders are the heroes of the story. And if that's true, just now culturally, people are just much less interested. There's a sort of proposition.
Well, they were purchased anyway a while back. So
yes.
Ben and Jerry's, I know the story better about Ben and Jerry's. I love ice cream. So.
Yeah.
But Ben and Jerry, yeah, I mean, they lost their, and it happens a lot with companies when they are purchased, you know, and the founders leave or are not as interested anymore.
Yeah. But I think the thing that's interesting, though, in the case of Ben and Jerry's, people then say, well, the answer is for the founders to rebuy it. But I wonder if it's more to your point in terms of the Sony story. There comes a point when you have to invent a new future, and actually rekindling the roots is kind of fine. But it's actually you get to a point where you have to be something new that's relevant in the new world. And I also think that's kind of hard in a lot of the companies and the ones I've been close to that have been really, really doubled down on sustainability over time. One of the challenges you get is that everybody that joins the company joins because they were fans of that brand and that proposition so much. So you almost get this kind of challenge when you're then into a place. So I worked a lot with an energy company that's big around green energy. And we went through with them in terms of how they appeal to the new group. And they had a real internal problem because everyone loved that company so much internally that they couldn't really get their head around the fact that the new consumers didn't care so much about the same things they cared about. And there was that kind of, it's less, less the fear of cannibalizing a different product and more the fear of, you know, the fact that the, you know, sometimes the reason the consumers are going to buy into your brand is very different from the reason that people work there. And that's a really hard conversation even to have.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. And I guess you're always going to run into a conflict when the product you create is so good, you don't have to buy another one for years and years and years. So,
yeah, I mean, as people know, as Nick and Fuzzle know, I'm a huge Patagonia guy, and I don't think I've ever actually bought a product new from them. I've always bought secondhand, which is the ultimate irony, is that I've got so many of their fleeces and jumpers and stuff in my wardrobe, but I haven't given them a single penny.
Part of the problem. Fantastic. So to wrap up and to finish off the podcast, we like to ask what your cultural pick of the week is. And this can be best music, film, TV, design, a book that you found interesting, something that's inspired you this week. Nicholas, let's kick off with you.
Well, that's you sure you don't want Selena, because I haven't thought about that question yet.
We can go to Selena.
Okay, I'll save you a couple seconds.
Thank you.
I recently discovered Crazy Ford, and it turns out she's Canadian as well. She's a musician. Fantastic, like not a bad song. So look her up. And then, of course, on the mapping side, if you're a fan of Atlas Obscura, which is history, science,
love
and culture
that
told through map, they actually have a book on food. And I'm a food history, culinary history nerd. So they have a gastro obscura book. So I peek at that now and then, because it's a couple hundred pages book of the world's foods in history. So that's a fun read.
I did not know that existed. It's interesting because lots of food doesn't come from where you think it does initially, or it comes in a collaboration with something else at some unexpected time. Okay, that's interesting.
All right. I thought about something that really has impressed me this week is, sorry, but about sports, but it's very cultural. On Saturday, we beat Ireland. France beat Ireland on the Six Nations tournament. And I was extremely happy about that because Ireland had never lost in like months, years. The last 10 games in Dublin, they haven't lost. And so for us, in terms of culture, that was your question, right? It's like in terms of culture, the whole of France was extremely pleased and that we have a potential of beating everybody and winning the Six Nations next week against Scotland. So,
apart from the last bit, I was about to say when it was in, with watching it together, everyone was very much supporting France last weekend. That was a great thing, and it was a hell of a performance. But then, I don't think we have any hope this weekend, but we'll still be supporting Scotland, obviously, against France.
Well, it's the same. I always support any teams that plays against England. Sorry.
No, exactly.
Yeah. You have to remember the 100-year war.
I was going to reference actually as well my cultural pick, a kind of sporting film. So it was at the Glasgow Film Festival, which closed last night, but it's a great festival for people that ever come across. And the closing film was a film called Making It to Munich, which is a film kind of about football, but in the same way as Jaws is not really a film about a shark, it's not really about football at all. Yeah. So it's about a guy who was, it's a documentary, and it's about a guy who had a very bad injury, was an aspiring and very quite good young footballer, was involved in a terrible road accident, and had all kinds of complications as a result. But when Scotland qualified for the Euros in football, or soccer for our North American listeners, him and his surgeon alongside him just agreed to cycle from Scotland to Munich, where the first game happened, and wow, took the pendant from the Scotland captain would exchange with the German captain. And it's a film, it's a very lovely film. It comes out, so it had its premiere at the festival. So it will hit normal cinemas apparently in May, okay, which is about a year since Euros. And it will, obviously outside of the UK, it might get quite a limited release, but it will get one. So if you come May time, if you like, it's more like a road movie, essentially, that happens to have football as the end point, I would say. So it's a really nice film about community.
Yes. Josh, anything from your side?
I stream on the film pick. So yesterday night I saw Bong Joon-ho's follow-up to Parasite, Mickey 17. And it's more back to his sort of sci-fi sort of roots of Robert Pattinson's part of this sort of force that's trying to colonize a planet. He dies and he comes back as a clone, and it sort of goes from there. That's just a very, very brief sort of byline of it, but there's proof that you can never have too much Robert Pattinson. So do with that as you will. Literally, there can be as many clones of him as you want.
It's a good place to end off today. A big thank you to all our guests for joining us today. And a thank you to everyone who has listened. We hope you're all caught up on the world of innovation this week. If you want to get access to label sessions for your brand and have your teams mentored by our leaders, get in touch via our website or any of the social networks around. See you next week.